And I thank you for your attention to our schedule today. Apparently, we've generated some interest, and for that, we're grateful. I'm going to move our agenda a little bit because I expect quite a lot of testimony on Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7. I'm going to do Senate Bill 11, and we have limited testimony on that. We have people from outside of the area traveled long distance to testify on 11. So with that, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Representative Mabry and Ernie Blatz, John Marshall. We're all where?
Probably in the hall.
Representative Mabry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for your patience in allowing me to testify and your indulgence. We do have people here that probably will want to testify on both sides of the issue of Senate Bill 11. I will leave that to your infinite wisdom to sort that out. My only comments would be, as it's presently written, Senate Bill 11 would eliminate the potential for a, if you will, a hostile takeover in corporate terms, in that large districts could take over small districts, and that would eliminate that potential. Unfortunately, at the same time it eliminates that potential, it has the potential to eliminate our citizens' access to the system, and I think that's a fundamental right and something that we should protect. The people that will speak after me will testify. I believe that there are some amendments that could be made that would accomplish both, which would give protection to the smaller school districts, that they would not have to fear a hostile takeover by a larger district, but at the same time protect that right of access to the system by individual members of the family, direct access. And so that's what I'm here to ask you to consider strongly. Mr. Blatz will speak more eloquently than I to those issues, as will perhaps others, but I thank you for your indulgence. And with that, I will go back to my other assignments, unless you have questions for me.
Hey there, any questions? Thank you very much. You bet.
I'd like to thank the Education Committee for allowing me to speak today, and I'd like to thank Senator Ted Farrioli for giving me a chance to speak before this committee on Senate Bill 11. As I understand it, Senate Bill 11
is... Excuse me. What? For the record, give us your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Ernie Blatz. I live in the Dalles.
Thank you.
As I understand it, Senate Bill 11 is being proposed to eliminate the possibility of a larger district taking over a smaller district. And I agree with this concept, but I don't agree with the Senate Bill 11 because it eliminates the entire county unit system. In the Dalles for the past 40 years, there have been two school districts, and over that period of time, several attempts to merge the two school districts. Therein lies the crux of the problem. Or the issue. In a consolidation and merger, the larger school district takes over, or the boards have to agree on positions. District 12 and District 9 were not working together, and the majority of the people in the community did not want the larger district to take over. The county unit system allows other options for the public to create a new school district where no existing district takes over. If the main purpose of Senate Bill 11 is to eliminate the possibility of a large school district taking over a smaller school district, instead of repealing the whole county unit system, Section 333060 could be changed to read as follows. Election to adopt a county unit system. This chapter shall not become effective in any county unit until the same has been regularly submitted to the electors of the proposed county school districts at a general or special election, and a majority of the votes cast from each district are in favor of making this chapter effective. If this isn't the main purpose of Senate Bill 11, then I ask, what is the main purpose, and what is the emergency of this bill that it must be effective July 1st of 2003? This bill's been on the books since 1959. The county unit system is another avenue for the community to make changes that are not available in the consolidation and merger statute. The county unit system allows you to create a new school district. The county unit system allows a group of people to become part of a county unit system without the permission of the district they belong to, thus giving the public freedom of choice. Thanks for your time and opportunity to speak. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them best I can.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blatt's questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this bill comes to us from the Interim Committee on Education. And this bill actually was pre-session filed. If you'll notice, the number is Senate Bill 11. It was the first bill filed after the President's reservation bills. And it was thoroughly researched by the Senate General Government Committee when they approved in pre-session, filed the bill. And it was known that the antiquated 1959 enactment was used in a form of hostile takeover, sort of as a way to force the issue of consolidation in Wasco County. While I don't disagree with the witness that indicates that this does, in fact, force everybody to use another mechanism, which is for consolidation of school districts, which is by mutual consent, which has been the only consolidations that we've had for a great number of years in Oregon. We haven't used this 1959 statute until it was very recently used in this election. The result of that use of this antiquated statute was extremely divisive and very disruptive to the school districts. It was, in fact, more or less just a loaded gun pointed at the heads of the school district. And the point of that is that we went through a very divisive period of forced consolidations of school districts in Oregon, and the universal agreement is that we're not going to do that anymore. It's just too divisive and too harmful to the education process. This vestige of the previous school wars, I think, needs to be out of our statute so that people realize that if we're going to have consolidations, it's got to be by mutual consent. So I was asked by the people of Wasco County to bring this bill to stop the potential that it would be used somewhere else, so the other districts wouldn't have to go through this divisiveness. And fortunately, the best part of this whole story is that the situation in Wasco County has been resolved. There has been an agreement to consolidate the district, and that was by election. I guess it was a great victory for those that used this tool, but it was very, very painful for the community. We've been working on the repeal of this bill for 2.5 sessions. So I'm hoping that, notwithstanding the testimony that we've heard today, that this tool that I think is so divisive, even though it does limit the choices of citizens, there's no question about that. Every statute that we have on the books limits somebody's choice. I hope that this committee moves this bill forward. I've heard discussion here today about a possible amendment. I guess I'd like to know more about what the amendment would accomplish. And that would be my question for the witnesses. What is the amendment that you're suggesting do?
What the amendment accomplishes is the ability for the people to still use the statute, and in creating a new school district, and in letting the group of people that want to separate from a school district to petition the district they want to join without having the vote, you know, from the, without having the school boards holding them hostage, pretty much. Right now, there, if we're talking about, you know, changing the statutes for merging and the county unit system, we probably need to look at the merging statute also, because it does not allow for the creation of a new school district. The largest district takes over. And in a lot of cases, that's not always the good thing. There's no options. Sometimes maybe the smaller district would be better taking over. But that's not a possibility under the merger statute. So I think that trying to push this through real fast isn't the proper channels in the proper direction to go. I think that if we're going to look at redoing the statutes for merging and the county unit system, we need to look at both statutes and try and build one good statute out of the two of them instead of just chopping one off completely. I do believe that it's not good for a larger district to take over a smaller district. And yes, that should be the main goal here. But the main goal, you know, also shouldn't be taking away the rights of people and the options when the existing statute doesn't have as many good options as what's needed in some of the situations. The DALs would have never passed under the merger statute. It would have never been done because nobody wanted the larger district to take over, not even the larger district. The boards did not work together. And if you go, so you use the option, well, the people can take a vote to the ESD and the ESD will put it on the ballot, it still drops down to 51% of each district has to vote on it. Well, if the largest district takes over and the smallest district doesn't want that, that's not what's going to happen then. Also, we need to look at that so that there is possibilities so that we can change the system and not just throw this one out completely.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might respond.
Yes, Senator Ferriola.
If we're referring to being in a hurry with the issuance or the issue of an emergency clause on this bill, the reason the emergency bill was included in this emergency clause was included in this bill was that it was a pre-session filed, and that was prior to the election. So, Mr. Chairman, there's really no necessity for the emergency clause in the bill anymore. But in terms of the emergency, as I said, we've been working on this now for the 2001 session, you might recall, this bill was here, and now it's back again. So I guess I would tell you that if having this bill on the books would encourage a whole bunch of school districts to be formed out of existing school districts, then that public policy piece is something that I would oppose. The fact of the matter is that we have one such situation in Ione currently, and it is very divisive, and there is a bill that is being proposed to allow Ione to have its own district. That's by way of sort of trying to figure out how Ione and the bigger district can get together and solve their problems. That bill, I think, has been brought forward more as an incentive to negotiate than anything else. But if this law isn't changed, and it really is a mechanism for people to get together and carve small school districts out of large school districts, that's even more reason to pass this bill, in my opinion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And I thank you. Unless there's further questions, we have John Marshall signed up to testify. Anyone else want to testify? Thank you very much, Mr. Glatz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, appearing before you in support of Senate Bill 11. I think Senator Ferrioli has explained the rationale for the bill. And I think the fundamental question is, when there's a merger, a consolidation, the creation of a new school district, whatever you want to call it, the fundamental question is, should there be a process to allow the involvement of local citizens? And I think the circumstance that brought this bill in the first place indicated that this current law creates a situation where there isn't the opportunity for the involvement of citizens to determine how their local school districts are organized. We have in ORS Chapter 330 very clearly a process for a simple boundary change, that is moving pieces of property from one school district to the other, or the total merger of two school districts. Now, while it is true that there's the possibility of a larger school district absorbing a smaller school district or vice versa, there's also the opportunity to, in effect, out of that merger, create a new school district with a new name, a new number, a new structure, and so forth. So there is a procedure in current law that allows citizen involvement to determine how their local schools are organized, and we believe that uniformly we ought to proceed with those communities that want to reorganize their school districts to do so under that particular set of statutes. As Senator Farioli suggested, this bill is the language in this bill was enacted in, or the language in this statute, the county unit organization statutes, was enacted in 1959. It's been very seldom, and the most recent occurrence in Wasco County was very divisive and expensive. And so I would suggest that Senate Bill 11 is a good idea to get rid of an archaic statute, to leave in place a process to involve citizens in determining how their schools are organized. I would encourage you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, that there are some amendments, the Dash 1 amendments, which very clearly state that the process that is currently underway to create a new school district out of the Dalles and Chenoweth should be able to proceed under these existing statutes. And in effect, that's what the Dash 1 amendments clarify, that by repealing the existing county unit statutes, that procedure can go forward to its natural conclusion. So we would encourage you to adopt the Dash 1, Senate Bill 11 Dash 1 amendments, and move the bill forward. Thank you very much.
Question. Farioli, you have seen the Dash 1 amendment?
I have, Mr. Chairman.
The committee members? We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 11, and we will move on to the other bills at this point. May come back to a work session before the end of this meeting today. In the meantime, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 437. And I believe we have you're representing Senator Clarno.
Yes, I am, Chair. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I'm here representing Senator Clarno. She sends her regrets that she was unable to attend today. She had some other legislative business that she had to attend to, but doesn't mean that her support isn't fully behind these two bills, Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7. I'd just like to introduce the bills today and kind of introduce some of the people that will be speaking to you. You're going to hear from a broad spectrum of people that care about our university systems here in Oregon, and they all understand that something has to be changed in order for those universities to become more efficient and more effective. Two-thirds of the Assembly has signed on to these bills. 62 members have signed on to SJR 7, and 60 members have signed on to Senate Bill 437. Oregon's major industry groups, the university presidents, and the State Board of Higher Education, and the university foundations are here, and they can all tell you why they share Senator Clarno's support for these bills. The fact is that we're using fewer tax dollars to support our universities, and we're relying on more and more tuitions and other funds. That may be understandable given the state's current fiscal situation, but what's not understandable is that we expect our universities to continue to do business as usual with fewer funds. These bills will help our universities meet the challenges presented by declining general fund revenues. Senate Bill 437 contains provisions that will allow Oregon's universities to be more flexible and efficient. And this bill eliminates duplication, redundant reviews, and places our research institutions on a level footing with other institutions across the country as they compete for research grants and develop innovations that will energize our local businesses and economy. SJR 7 will leverage private contributions in a fiscally responsible manner by changing the match requirements for higher education in the Oregon Constitution. And that ends my testimony for Senator Clarno, and I'd just like to thank you for hearing these bills today, and thank you, Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to notify those who are listening that we're reconstituted as subcommittee of Education Committee until I get more members back here, but we're going to proceed, and with that, I guess the agenda is that we have AOI, AEA, OBC, and PBA all here to help us out and with acronyms, and please come up, introduce yourself. Wonderful to have you here in support of our university system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, Oregon Council. AEA is the nation's largest high-tech trade association, and we've been involved here in this building on higher ed issues since about 1982. And it's one of the one of our biggest emphasis in our public policy work is supporting higher education in the state of Oregon. Joining me today are Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries, Duncan Wise from Oregon Business Council, Mike Salzgiver from the Portland Business Alliance just called and got detained, so he was going to be on our panel, but I think he's stuck in traffic or something, so he does send his regrets. We are, our four organizations are the actual formal requesters of this legislation, and I think it's telling that Oregon's largest and oldest business association, Associated Oregon Industries, and one could argue its newest association, Portland Business Alliance, both joined together today on as requesters of Senate Bill 437. I appreciate your hearing on this bill and appreciate the co-sponsorship of the members of this committee and the other 56 some odd members of the body who have joined us as co-sponsors of Senate Bill 437. We have plenty of people in the room today that can explain the nuances of the bill. I just want to give just a little real quick history of the genesis of this legislation. Nearly a year ago, President Frohmeyer from the University of Oregon and his senior staff joined Duncan and I and Mike Salzgiver at a meeting to talk about some new ideas they had for increased flexibility and operating efficiency within higher ed. And our assignment to them at that meeting was go back and bring us seven college university presidents supporting this bill and the support of the State Board of Higher Ed, and we'll form a partnership, because we think sometimes too often we divide up our higher ed campuses instead of working uniformly together. So they took the challenge and they accomplished the task, and working out throughout last year in the middle of all the special sessions and such, I believe this bill comes to you today with the support of all seven Oregon University System presidents and the strong support of the State Board of Higher Education. And that was our intent, and they accomplished that goal. Just a couple of high-level comments about the bill itself. There's a lot of issues in here about flexibility and efficiency. We think those are always good themes in good times and in bad. We think perhaps they are critical now in the very difficult times that higher ed and the state finds itself in, not just for higher ed, but for all state agencies, to find ways to work quicker, faster, more efficient, and to perhaps get rid of some of the log jams and multiple levels of review that can slow down an enterprise that's trying to change and adapt. I think you'll hear today from a number of commentators some fear of change, some fear of this may upset the apple cart a tad, maybe a different way of doing things, but really that's the intent. That's the goal of this bill, is to change and is to adapt to changing times. And so rather than being afraid of change, we say, that's a good thing, and we're glad that the universities are bringing some of those concepts to you today. I do not think this bill removes the legislature in any way from oversight over this institution and these institutions. I think it forms a partnership between the legislature and the business community and the institutions, and ultimately our students, who are the most important goal of all this at the end of the day. So I think I think oversight continues under all the changes in this bill. Perhaps there will be a little less oversight of one state agency by another state agency, but we don't think that's a reason to slow this down and not to move forward. So we thank you again for your consideration, and there's plenty of people in the room who will explain all the nuances and the section by sections of the bill. We just want to give it our strong endorsement and thank the system for working with us to bring you this important legislation.
Thank you very much. Questions? We are now reconstituted as a full committee of the Education Committee. Thank you, Senator Perio. Please.
Good afternoon. I'm Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. Associated Oregon Industries began in 1895 as an organization to promote Oregon products and is Oregon's largest business association representing over 27,000 industries. Our member businesses employ over 325,000 of Oregon's private employees, and our members are highly dependent on the quality of education provided by Oregon's universities. And as a matter of record, AOY was a key supporter of the university system's last great bill, the 99 higher education bill that increased higher education funding by 26%. I see us having three problems in higher education today, and I think Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7 will positively impact those three problems. They are state spending, obviously has favored K-12. To the exclusion of higher education. Secondly, higher education systems haven't had the flexibility to respond to market demands. And thirdly, say with the passage of ballot measure 10, universities now have the incentive to become more fiscally independent and have the potential to become economic drivers of our economy, but they lack the tools. Our interest is specifically what I want to emphasize is section 2 of this bill, which deals with technology transfer. Technology transfer is an engine that turns university-created intellectual capital into the stuff of general commerce and economic health. Startup companies, jobs, tax revenues, etc. The current system of state requirements works against the delicate timing element that is so critical to the success of many technology transfer agreements. Cumbersome and redundant requirements are a bottleneck that slows responsiveness and limits opportunity. And we expect universities to continue to push in the field of technology transfer, and our public-private partnerships will continue to increase. Our universities should continue to seek legal advice, but on a value-added basis. So we strongly support the provisions exempting OUS from legal sufficiency review. This doesn't mean that our universities will take unacceptable risks, or should, or forego appropriate legal review in contracting. Instead, it means that the university system will have the flexibility to make informed decisions about legal involvement in its contracting based on complexity of issues and risk. Coupled with other language in the bill that allows our universities to hire their own legal counsel, industry feels that there is much that can be gained in the area of technology transfer with a more streamlined legal review process. And I have a couple of stories I've been able to glean from the university system that I think emphasize the necessity of this issue in Section 2. A problem occurred when university researchers wanted to access a database from another research university outside of Oregon. To do so, the university team decided to purchase software which was available from no other source. And the university found itself facing the Department of Justice requirement to make sure that the agreement would include language requiring that the out-of-state group complied with Oregon workers' compensation statutes, even though the software purchased required no visits from that outside company. The software company believed this provision was highly unreasonable, and the company was unwilling to comply and deal with Oregon, so the deal eventually fell through. A second example of this was not long ago a university technology transfer staff person successfully negotiated a sponsored research agreement with a multinational Japanese corporation. And after a year of successful interaction and promising results in collaboration with the university, the company wanted to renew the agreement. And as a result, the university's research would be extended and students would have additional jobs and foreign funds would flow into Oregon's economy and other desirable effects would also accrue. But the university is required to ask the Japanese corporation to show, to the satisfaction of the state, that the company would comply with the Oregon workers' compensation regulations for any employee who might be injured while in Oregon. And the corporation refused, and although eventually an agreement was reached, time was wasted attending to this extreme degree of risk avoidance. According to the university officials, this episode has not been conducive to the subsequent relationships with the firm. So in conclusion, with the passage of Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7, I think you have the opportunity to dramatically improve higher education in Oregon and give the system the tools it needs to become an economic contributor to our state's economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. Thank you for holding the hearing today on SB 437. The Oregon Business Council is an association of 40-some-odd CEOs of a variety of large Oregon companies. Higher education is almost always at the very top of our list when we set priorities. It has been for many years. In the late 1990s, we engaged in an extensive task force on higher ed policy and government. And as part of that work, we took a hard look at the state system of higher education in relation to state government. And the conclusions we reached then are really conclusions that have you see in this bill today, in these bills today. And the conclusion was that over time, higher ed has changed in its relationship with state government from one where it was essentially a state agency, largely funded with state funds in a very traditional way as a state agency, to one today where a small fraction of the funds that go into the budgets of individual campuses come from the state, and yet we still act as though these campuses are state agencies. And as we examine the world of higher education, the world we're likely to move into going forward, we see an era where higher ed is going to be ever more important, where we're going to need nimble, responsive, adaptive services that meet a variety of Oregon needs. And we see the state, unfortunately, playing a smaller role in terms of funding, yet still trying to have all the strings associated with those institutions that in fact need flexibility and nimbleness to reach other sources of funds, private sector funds, federal funds, and a variety of other different sources. And that's the context which I think we find ourselves as you take a look at this bill, a context where the institutions find themselves in a very different place than where they were when they were designed. And this is a really one, I would argue, modest step to redesign the system, to give the schools more flexibility to meet the needs. Harvey did a wonderful job, I think, of giving you specific examples of the problems created by the current system. As we've gone around the state, talked with individual campuses, they're riddled. We are just finding example after example of challenges facing the campuses as they try to be responsive, to try to meet needs on the ground in terms of the procurement processes and the oversight processes they experience, whether it's building a new building, doing technology transfer, or any variety of areas of program development and new areas of focus. So as we look at it again, roughly one-fifth of the dollars today in these campuses come from the state, yet we treat the campuses in a traditional way. We think that this bill gives the campuses more flexibility. It's a process where the chancellor asked the campuses to tell what they needed to be successful, what they want, what flexibility would be required to help them be more flexible. It's a very reasonable set of suggestions, and I would encourage you to take a hard look at them and move ahead with this bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Duncan. I'm battling a cold, so bear with me. The presidents may address this, but I guess the only concern that I might offer up and be interested in the panel's take on it is this in some ways waving the white flag on funding of looking at a decade of really poor state performance of funding of higher ed, and certainly a poor, I think we led the country in per capita cuts in the last 16 months on higher ed funding. And is that a concern that y'all might have, that in some ways by doing this, our nature is, if you look at past decisions, the further, the funding doesn't follow. And so I'm curious as to...
I'll take first, Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard. I think we've got to recognize... I don't think so. The answer... I think you have a responsibility to provide resources for post-secondary education. You will have that. But I think the reality is this, and we've said it in our report in 97, and we've looked at other states. The reality is demand for these services are growing enormously. It's not just the young people moving into the system. It's lifelong learning. And what we see in post-secondary is ever-growing demand for new services in a whole variety of ways throughout life. And I don't think there's any realistic expectation that you're going to be able to chase through your dollars all the demand that's coming. And so we just have to recognize. So you're going to have to be very much more targeted in what you provide. That doesn't mean it should be less, because, again, demand is growing. But you're going to have to be very focused on where your dollars are going. And I think the model I would have in your mind is one we presented in the white paper in the Oregon Business Plan, is a procurement model. It seems to me your job is to identify what services you want and make sure you're procuring them from institutions that are very nimble, flexible, and efficient. What you need, so therefore, I'd say your role as being that procurement role, and giving the schools the flexibility and nimbleness to provide those services very well in what is a, what I frankly say is going to be an ever more competitive marketplace for services. And so I think if you see it in that light, I think you'll make the right decisions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, go ahead.
Mr. Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to listen to the rest of the panel and ask my question afterwards.
All right.
Never want to interrupt. Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Senator Deckard, I absolutely agree. And it's really clear at the first hearing on this bill and the opening panel to clarify, this is not the OHSU model. This is not Senate Bill 2 or whatever it was. This is not forming public corporations and cutting all the apron strings. This is really, and other people can speak to this, I think the legislative engagement in higher ed is not changed much by this set of recommendations. The interaction between higher ed and some other state agencies is changed in some fashion in this bill. But I do not think this is an out of sight, out of mind. And we certainly share the point you're making. Higher ed is going to remain under this rubric, a very closely interrelated to the legislature, in my opinion.
And Chair Starr, Senator Deckard, I would just add that I think this is emblematic of a change in universities, that they want to be more involved with the economy. And the economy and jobs are requiring such a high level of education now. I think that is a movement that we're in a fortunate position to be able to influence and help. And they need tools right now to help them be more nimble and more market-driven and better able to respond to economic demands. And I think this provides that without sacrificing oversight.
Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'll notice, Mr. Chairman, that I joined my peers in sponsorship of these two proposals. So at the outset, I want to begin my comments by saying that I absolutely believe that these are necessary changes and reasonable. But I'm experiencing somewhat a sense of deja vu, and perhaps it isn't of this panel that I want the assurances, but of the presidents of the universities, that flexibility and nimbleness and new opportunities were comments that we heard describing the deregulation of electricity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm not trying to make anybody uncomfortable here, but I think it is incumbent on us to understand that the words legal sufficiency is somewhat like describing Caesar's wife. It means that this process is beyond suspicion, above suspicion. And I want assurances from the university community that what we really are after is creating a new tool and real flexibility and nimbleness in the best sense and new opportunity, but that they recognize that there is some potential for peril in this application of this new tool, of this new power, of this new flexibility. And those of us that have come into this building following, you know, in the footsteps of our predecessors and standing, as it were, on the shoulders of giants or midgets, depending on who your favorite legislator is, have lived through the recapitulation of disbursements that were made from SAFE, from the Department of Veterans Affairs, from a whole host of people, where the legislature itself took flexibility, nimbleness, and new opportunities, and it turned out to be an exploding cigar. So I guess I just want to hear the reassurances from the university community that they understand that this new tool has terrible responsibilities that come with it. And as I said, Mr. Chairman, this is probably not the panel that needs to respond to that.
And Mr. Chair, we agree.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much. Thank
with
you.
With that, we're going to call the chancellor up. And Chancellor Jarvis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. And if I may, some introductory comments. There are really three factors that set the context for this bill. The first of them is the work of the State Board of Higher Education, in particular, its Strategic Planning Committee, who've been engaged in the Strategic Planning Project for over a year now, examining all of the main policy agendas of the Oregon University System, including the ways in which we relate to the rest of state government, the ways in which we relate to the rest of the sectors of education within the state of Oregon, and indeed the ways in which we do our business. Part of their thinking brings to you this set of efficiency proposals contained in the bill under consideration today. And with me today, here at the panel, is Roger Bassett, a member of the State Board, familiar, I'm sure, to many of you. He will be speaking shortly on the work of the Strategic Planning Committee of that State Board. The second factor has been the desire of the presidents of our universities to seek out more efficient practices on their campuses and more efficient practices in the ways in which we interact with the rest of state government, ways in which we're able to generate revenue, to secure resources, to invest income, and to do more with the resources that the state provides. The purpose of this is to teach more students, to enable us to conduct more research, and to expand the program base that we deliver. We've identified, as the first panel hinted, a number of ways in which we believe we can work better, we can work faster, and we can work more economically in our relationships with the state. In all of those, we will maintain and indeed increase our accountability within the system to the State Board, and through the State Board to state government and to you. A third factor that drives the need for this bill is the pressure on state funding, and what that means for our ability to maintain access. That is, of course, an overwhelming priority for all of us in this room. We know that the extent of state resources in the next biennium simply will not be able to support, through general fund, the number of students that will want to come to our institutions, who will be qualified academically, and will need the benefits that a baccalaureate education and beyond can bring. But that access requires dollars. Whether the dollars are state general fund, whether the dollars are from tuition, or whether the dollars are realized through efficiency savings and investments through Senate Bill 437. With that, let me turn over to Roger Bassett to describe the work of the State Board, and I will then come back and elaborate further on access after Roger has spoken.
Chair Starr and members of the Senate Education Committee, for the record, I'm Roger Bassett, a member of the State Board of Higher Education for about a year and a half now. I reside at 4858 Shade Tree Lane in Turner, Oregon. I'm also the chair of the Strategic Planning Committee of the board to which this work came and within which it was developed, and wanted to assure you, should you have any doubts or questions about it, that each of the elements in it have been considered by the board in a very thorough process. It began in a full board work session of about a day's duration as we wrestled with the larger question of state and local resources versus state and local responsibility and how to balance those up in these changing times. It was then placed in the hands of the Strategic Planning Committee, which chose to expand into a work group that included a larger representation in the full university system community and then back to the full board where all elements were debated and approved. Senators, we are engaged, as are you, in trying to find that combination of state and local resources, student tuition being the chief local resource in our case, and state and local responsibility or division of leadership labor, if you prefer, with which we can respond to Oregon's troubled economy and troubled public finance system. These difficulties are not ours alone, but I wanted to assure you that as one of the boards that you keep an eye on, we are doing that in all of our work, not just in the work that brought this legislation to you. And as we continue that discussion, those discussions, we observed that the responsibility for sustaining Oregon University system enrollment capacity, whether we wished for this or predicted this or not, is shifting towards institutional campus communities and institutional leadership. That shift is happening. It is not dramatic. It is not the sort of thing that is creating crises. Some days we wish maybe for more than we are creating, but it is not. It's happening in the hands of very capable leaders many of whom you will hear from shortly. This legislation invites your approval of a set of tools that, in our judgment, will help those local campus communities and presidents work with this reality, the reality that seems to be increasingly their responsibility to keep the campus doors open. The Board of Higher Education will continue our efforts looking at a whole series of issues, including student affordability, which is a subject that Senator Morissette and I have some seat time on several years ago, question of mission differentiation. The work of the Oregon Business Council and the other business leadership organizations have created a context within which we find ourselves well served. We'll continue to do that. We're looking to craft policies that will maximize student access within the resources, state and local, that we have. What your approval of this bill will do is enable our presidents to do their considerable part in that effort, a part becoming much larger as state resources become more limited. Thank you. Be glad to answer questions.
Questions? Any? Thank you very much.
If I may continue.
Yes,
and continue.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The point then of these reforms is to provide us with a way to increase the number of students that we can support. When the state general fund has been determined for higher education, that will set the number of students at each of our institutions who can enroll during the course of the next biennium. It'll determine the infrastructure that supports the research that our faculty can do and their ability to secure external grants and contracts. But beyond that, our institutions will be supporting thousands of additional students on the basis of tuition alone, which we're doing right now to the tune of some 6,000 to 8,000. And beyond that, we believe that a significant number of additional students could be reached and served if the elements of this Efficiency Act are approved and implemented. It is a complex bill with many provisions. One of them relates to our working relationships with the Department of Justice. You have a copy of a letter from the Attorney General to me, and it reflects our joint concerns and agreements. I understand the Department of Justice has amendments they're going to advance, and I've asked my staff and colleagues to work on this process as soon as possible. I'd like to acknowledge the very real concerns of the campuses in this area, the very real concerns of business and industry in this area, and those of the department. All are working under great pressure. I appreciate very much the intent of our colleagues in the business community who are seeking a legislative solution to help us with this. And I also believe that a negotiated approach that directly involves all parties is very much worth exploring. Let me conclude. We are seeking increased flexibility. We are seeking efficiencies from state government. We are not seeking a public corporation. We are not seeking the privatization of Oregon's public universities. We are not taking the state out of the state university. And we are not seeking separation of the state. For me, there are 750 million good reasons why I'd like to remain extremely close to the state of Oregon and very accountable in that relationship. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleague presidents. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First panel of presidents, please come forward.
Deja vu all again.
good to see you back here again. So fully involved with us like that.
Thank you very much, Chairman Starr. We very much appreciate your welcome today. For the record, I'm Dave Fonmeyer, President of the University of Oregon. This is an important day, and one where I think it's fair to say to my colleagues, and I consider the two bills before you to be the most significant legislative package that you will address this session. We obviously hope for your affirmative vote and support. We believe that Oregon's economic future depends upon a successful and sustainable higher education system. From training our workforce to providing the research and technology transfer of new discoveries, our universities are a critical link to this Oregon economy, which this entire legislative assembly is working so hard to help sustain. Investing in higher education isn't, in this respect, just another expenditure. It is an investment in Oregon's economic future. One example from one institution, real figures verified by a senior economist. The University of Oregon is the state's 18th largest employer. It returns $10 to the state in expenditures for every $1 it receives from taxpayers. That's true of virtually every university represented here, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to give you some context for why Senate Bill 437 and Senate Joint Resolution 7 are so important to help us meet the demands of the 21st century. Today, we have the largest enrollment in our 126-year history at the University of Oregon, more than 20,000 students, and more than 1,000 of them, by the way, that receive no state support at all as a result of budget cuts that have just been made. And we're confident that this demand for our services by our young and not-so-young people will continue into the indefinite future. But we're being pulled in two directions by increasing enrollments and declining state support. And the same can be said for our other six institutions of higher education. In the early 1990s, we received more than 30% of our total revenues from the state of Oregon. And now, after the most recent expenditure cuts, we receive less than 17%, nearly a 50% cut in funding over the space of a decade. The University of Oregon, and indeed the university system, cannot continue on this path. So to survive in this continuing environment of increased enrollment demand for all the right reasons and declining state support, we came together. All seven universities, the Chancellor, the Board of Higher Education, and our friends from Oregon's business and industry associations to develop a proactive plan to help us deal with this in a way that's not business as usual, in a way that benefits the entire state. This plan is, in other words, our best thinking for the future of a sustainable higher education system. We're extraordinarily grateful to the 60 members who have signed on as sponsors or co-sponsors, and we are very grateful to each member of this committee who is a co-sponsor of this bill. We thank you for that faith. I've been asked to discuss a few key strategic points, and I will keep my remarks as brief as I possibly can. We're asking for flexibility. And yes, Senator Farioli, it does involve risk that we engage knowingly and responsibly, I believe, in ways that I hope that we can make clear to the committee. To help us increase non-state revenue, that's first. To help us operate more efficiently by regulatory reform of other regulations dealing with other state agencies and entities, and to increase our entrepreneurial activity. First, with respect to increasing non-state revenues. In this environment, obviously, it's very difficult to provide adequate funding for public higher education. And we need in this, because of our enrollment demand, to be given flexibility to set tuition based upon market demand. Now, I follow that statement with some very important qualifications and amplifications. This does not mean we will turn our backs on qualified Oregon high school students from low-income families who would not otherwise be able to afford the University of Oregon or any other institution. Any tuition increases will be accompanied by increased financial aid to assure affordability and access for all qualified Oregonians who are seeking an education at the University of Oregon. In light of this most recent surcharge that we've instituted, I think with your knowledge, as a necessity to deal with the failure of Measure 28 and other measures, we have already diverted $500,000 from merit aid to our students to need-based aid. We will continue to meet federal guidelines that help to define what the level of financial assistance needs to be for students based upon scholarships, grants, loans, and work study. We have indeed, as you may know, offered an off-hours tuition discount to students who take classes at hours of the day that enables us to use our physical plant more effectively. And we find those hours fully subscribed, and that students who take classes at those hours can, in fact, get a price break that enables them to predict and stabilize the expenditures that they'd spend for tuition. And one final quick and important point that I wish I had more time to emphasize, but I wish to note it now, that if a student is forced because of the lack of classes available or sections to study in or laboratory space available to extend his or her education by one term or two terms, that far exceeds in total cost to the student what a percentage increase in tuition for a given term might be that would allow that student to receive a degree on time and to enter the workforce and to begin earning productive salaries or wages. So we do not intend to compromise access, and my colleague Tim White from Oregon State University will speak much more fully to this point. Scholarships are an essential part of where we wish to go in the 21st century, and we've launched the silent phase now of the largest campaign for any cause in the history of Oregon, public or private, a new Oregon campaign that will help to define this. Scholarships are a centerpiece of the money that we will raise because we understand the need that we have to continue to provide that special opportunity for Oregon's citizens. In that respect, the respect of raising funds, Senate Bill 437 contains a critically important provision regarding donor privacy that's critical to our ability fully to raise the private contributions that are increasingly important as a funding source. This language should be no stranger to members of the committee or members of the public or members of the news media with whom we have discussed it, because the language is the same and gives us the ability to provide the same donor privacy protections that are already provided by this legislative assembly to the Oregon Health and Sciences University as it seeks private funds as well. These two measures make changes also to help us lower our administrative costs. They help to devolve authority to the campus level where decisions are made and allow us more flexibly to meet the demands of current higher education market. We believe, and I think you'd share that belief, that one size does not fit all, either in terms of what the tuition amounts might be on a given campus or the particular regulatory requirements that the campus needs to confront. We've asked in this bill that OUS be given greater authority to manage legal and contractual issues. I look forward, as does the Chancellor, to working with the Attorney General to find language and practices that all parties can support. This market-based approach, I think, is novel in higher education and portends the future. And Senator Ferrarelli, to respond to your very appropriate question, let me tell you that we are not risk-averse, nor are we unaccustomed to risk. Just a quick example. If we were to set our prices too high for out-of-state students and 100 non-resident students from abroad or from other states did not show up as planned, we lose $1 million. So we understand the costs that taking a risk that's ill-advised might be. We understand the risk of pricing ourselves out of a market, and these kinds of market controls are part of the fabric of overall controls that this bill requires us to live within. We bring in our universities against all odds, I must say, in praise of my colleagues, in a particularly unpredictable financial climate. They have survived over the last decade and at least over the last biennium through heroic efforts by many people. If you give us the tools to deal with these risks, we promise you that we will exercise them responsibly and vibrantly for the future of our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Fromer, just one question, if you can
please
hear me, if you can make it out. On tuition policy, I think it's laudable what you've done since the surcharge has gone into effect. What assurances, when there is a new president or a new administration, if we pass this, that the new administration would make the same decision in terms of transferring part of the tuition increase into need-based aid? I guess what assurances, and does the state provide a needed check that before this bill would be passed to give students and Oregonians that assurance?
Well, one thing I need to mention, Senator Deckard, is that this bill does not require any change in the current legislative policy for the setting of tuition. That policy is to have tuition set by the State Board of Higher Education, and that provision has been in the statutes for as long as I can remember, and I've been a re-resident of this state, if you will, when I came back, for 30 years. So there's no change in the overall supervisory responsibility of the State Board of Higher Education to make sure that education is affordable, that each institution is operated responsibly, that the revenue it generates still is in the context of giving opportunity to students. What it does do is obviously make that tuition setting responsibility in terms of the ranges that the board sets for each of the institutions a special point of access, and that's one that is available to students readily and which they avail themselves of very readily these days. In addition to that, we obviously have an interest in maintaining our enrollment. And any time we were to price ourselves too high, students would vote with their feet. We know that they do that because we've seen it happen elsewhere. And beyond that point, we have an obligation that we regard as an ethical one. And I believe that any successor of mine or ours would see that that same responsibility to be a steward of a student's opportunity would continue to remain.
Thank you very much.
May I ask a question?
Senator Marcet.
Thank you. President Frohmeyer, I have been present at several occasions when we welcomed the foreign students to the University of Oregon, and I understand how important they are to the environment of the university, the learning environment, as well as the financial environment. And so my question is, are we maintaining the level of foreign students that we have? And I guess it's a broader question for the entire system, not just the University of Oregon. So are we able to continue to attract? Is it increasing, decreasing, staying the same?
Let me answer the question, foreign student, in two ways. We have a non-resident category. Some are simply students who are domestic United States citizens but outside the state of Oregon. If you mean international students.
International students.
Yeah, so we have actually seen...
I don't
seen,
consider someone from Montana as being
foreign. No. For tuition purposes, they are non-resident. We welcome them, Senator, with open arms. We've actually found a decline in our international student registration for two reasons. Not great, and it is one that we worry about, and we spend a lot of time successfully in recruiting them. But the Asian currency crisis of 1997 and 98 was very serious for the University of Oregon because of the dire impact that it had on places where our students had come from. We've largely recovered from that. The second and more serious ongoing set of issues are the issues with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, or whatever its new name is, in the Homeland Security Department, because the ability of students to get visas and visa clearance in a timely way is actually very, very critical to us. Mm-hmm. And happily, our international student numbers have held. They're slightly below what we would actually like them to be in terms of the global diversity that a campus such as ours should represent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Starr, Senator Deckard, Tim Morissette. For the record, I'm Tim White, the President of Oregon State University, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss these two bills that will greatly improve the future of higher education in Oregon and, as a consequence, better serve Oregonians and facilitate our economic recovery and development. Senate Bill 437 contains dozens of provisions, as you've heard, that allow for both flexibility and efficient use of the funds that you do provide to us through appropriations. And Senator Deckard, it's not waving a white flag and not asking you for our fair share of state appropriations, but it's really trying to maximize the ability to use those in a very productive way. And when Senator Farioli returns, it's not an exploding cigar, as he likened, rather a responsibility that we'll take very seriously and be fully accountable for. Let me speak briefly to just two of the several provisions. The Office of Degree Authorization is the first provision I'd like to speak to. Two sessions ago, you had the good judgment to create a funding model for higher education that allows funds to travel to each campus largely based on enrollment. The dollars follow the students, and it should be no surprise to any of us that student demand typically mirrors what employers are looking for. So the current model also responds to the job market, and it will enhance economic recovery and development for Oregon by enhanced workforce development and by the creation of those new ideas that have commercial applications.
But under the current statutes, when we offer a new degree program, we must undergo a tertiary review by the Office of Degree Authorization. This tertiary review comes after the campuses and the academic council and the council of presidents and the state board have looked at the merits of the program. It delays our responsiveness. It duplicates and provides an unnecessary level of academic and financial review. And so it provides no really added benefit to the taxpayers of Oregon. And it's one clear example of an inefficient use of state general fund dollars. Now, the original impetus behind the ODA review was to keep public institutions from unfairly competing with private institutions. And that may have been a concern back when the state provided a significant portion of the cost of a college education. But as you've learned, it's somewhere between 18 and 19% today. But what really makes the review unnecessary for ODA is that it considers geographical proximity as a factor in determining whether state-funded programs are competing with private programs. This is clearly an antiquated notion in the day of the Internet. The Internet now makes it possible for a student to take classes from two institutions and from two locations at the same time in yet a third location. And given the reduction in state support for public universities, the increased reliance on tuition dollars, and the elimination of geographical place as a factor, we believe whatever benefits were originally intended for ODA have outlived their usefulness. And I will tell you, when I first came to the great state of Oregon in 1996 as a dean, I tried to initiate a new program in physical therapy and discovered the power of the ODA in ways that even surprised me. And that is that physical therapy graduate programs do not exist in the public institutions in the state of Oregon. I believe it's the only state in the union that doesn't have a public physical therapy program. But there's one at Pacific. And they simply were able to rattle the swords and prevented us from moving forward with that program. If that had not happened today, we would have a much less expensive program for Oregonians to enroll in. And we'd be producing somewhere between 36 and 48 physical therapists per year, which would be added into a needed part of our allied health economy. That's one example that I've personally experienced. Finally and briefly, let me just say that the issues around tuition flexibility and access are really designed for us to be able to create affordable access to quality education. The flexibility in setting tuition does not provide any carte blanche ability of the institutions to create tuition levels that are beyond the need. But as we decrease, for necessary reasons, the amount of state appropriations to higher education, we simply have to be able to increase tuition and fees, generate more private resources, and find extramural funding for our grants and contracts in order to open the doors and provide access to quality. And we're simply looking for the ability to manage prudently all aspects of that sort of integrated system. So we take the tuition increases very seriously and are committed to provide our students with additional assistance. As President Frommeyer said at Oregon State, likewise, we have moved this year some unbudgeted resources, a significant number, to help the students who cannot afford to pay the tuition surcharge that we were forced to use this year. We're using general funds and private funds through our foundation to increase the amount of money that we're able to allocate to the most financially needy. We're absolutely committed as a policy at our institution, as well as sort of a commitment to the social justice of access to public education, to always be thoughtful about and provide necessary resources for those students who do not have the resources to attend the university. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Dan Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. Portland State is committed to being a part of Oregon's economic recovery, and we believe that Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7 are integral to helping us be more responsive to our constituencies. Portland State is on the path to grow from 23,000 students to serve 35,000 students by 2010. And I might add, Senator Morissette, that a part of that growth will be in the number of international students that we hope to attract. We're currently remaining steady, but we're hoping to actually increase the number of international students and non-resident students from about 15% currently to probably about 30% at some point, because we believe that that kind of diversity is important to the educational process as well. PSU is also key to preparing Oregon's workforce for high jobs, high-wage jobs, for creating high-wage jobs for industry, and for being a part of the economic development and urban renewal by attracting new industries to Oregon. And today I just want to talk very briefly about two provisions that are especially important to Portland State. First, Sections 5 and 6 of Senate Bill 437 provides OUS with greater flexibility in offering health care plans for our employees. And currently, we are a part of the PEB system along with every other campus in the system. And while that is a very generous plan, it is also very expensive. At PSU, we believe that allowing us to go on the open market, given the demographics of our faculty and staff, they tend to be younger, and they're more often than not part of households where one or more adult is already insured by another provider, that we would be able to offer different yet comparable and less expensive options to our employees. The current system that's operated by the Public Employees Benefit Board does not provide incentives, for example, for someone who's insured by a spouse or partner, and so consequently we're often providing double coverage without any benefit to the university. So we believe we would be in a more competitive position to recruit faculty and staff if we were allowed to work with our unions to identify plans that were much more flexible and allowed for more significant cashback options or a combination of cashback and salary to our employees. The second provision that I wanted to speak to briefly is SJR 7, which changes the match requirements for Article 11G bonds that are used for facility construction. The current match requirements are 1-to-1, and SJR 7 would change that match to 3 bonds to 1 other funds. This provision is also very important because OSU institutions are all involved in private fundraising as a way of building new facilities. The increased match, I believe, would provide greater incentives to potential donors as we continue in these public-private partnerships to build facilities. It will allow us having greater flexibility then to work directly as presidents on raising funds for students and improving our programs to support our faculty in addition to raising money for facilities. So with that, I say thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. President Bernstein, that's an interesting number that you have for foreign students, the goal that you have, and I think it's great educationally to have an integrated campus. And I also understand that maybe Portland might be, in many ways, a more attractive destination place, and also the programs that you're teaching. But my question is, what do you consider the optimum number of foreign students as opposed to state students and maybe out of state? I mean,
we think the mix that we are working towards eventually is about 67% in-state residents, because PSU has always had an access mission, and we believe that we can continue to serve that access mission. But at the same time, we hope that we can combine access and serve the resident Oregonians, but at the same time increase the number of non-residents and international students from about 15% to 30 to 35%, and that would be an appropriate mix for us.
Okay. Thanks.
Senator Decker.
Thank you. We heard earlier a couple of examples of problems with the DOJ, the relationship with the universities with DOJ. It'd be helpful. That was certainly helpful for me to hear specific concrete examples. If one of the presidents have an example or two where the relationship just is burdensome and overly bureaucratic, I think that would be also helpful, at least to myself, to hear a couple of additional examples of where the current relationship just is not working.
What, yeah, that would do.
Well,
Senator Decker, this is puts all of us in somewhat of an awkward position, given the fact that the Attorney General has pledged to work with the institutions to try to find language that would be acceptable here. And I find myself in an unusual position of having been an Attorney General, and having been an on-campus legal advisor, which is how I began my career these many years ago in 1971, and now currently a university president attempting to deal with these issues. What the campuses look for is immediate responsiveness. What the Attorney General's office, I think, tries to find is immediate responsiveness. The issue that I'm wrestling with, and that I've had candid discussions and helpful discussions with the Attorney General on, is this one. It's very practical for us. We are, in essence, a city within a city. We have a full range of services 24 hours a day. It's unlike almost any other state agency in that respect. We have our own security force. We have our own living quarters. We cook our own food. We have our own power plants. We have our own radio stations and telecommunications facilities. And so it really calls for the presence of someone on the spot all the time who's very broadly based. Now, a lot of lawyers can do that, and I'm not saying that the Attorney General's office can't. But many times the lawyer does things that are very policy related. That is to say, the lawyer will sit in a negotiation session. The lawyer will sit in as an advisor who's versed in the law, but whose primary responsibility a good part of the time is to keep you doing things legally as well as to do so efficiently. And it's being able to have that kind of mix on hand as part of your staff that we're searching for. So I've given you a problem definition rather than trying to tell you where a fellow state agency has stubbed its toe. I don't think that's productive from my standpoint, but I'm telling you the kind of flexibility we're looking for. A person who is legally trained, who operates with the authority of the Attorney General's office or in contact with it or deputized by it, but has also the capacity to be on our staff and perform other roles, negotiating contracts, sitting in with employee grievances, these kinds of things that are part of running a small city within a city. I hope that's helpful to the senator.
Y'all are working towards a deal on, are in conversations on finding some middle ground on this issue.
Well, I have learned yesterday and today that the Attorney General has made an offer, and I've seen a copy of the letter that he sent to this committee. And out of deference to what the Attorney General said, I don't feel it productive publicly to talk about specific instances that might make those discussions unfruitful.
Yes.
Well, I might just comment, Chair Starr and Senator Deckard. I am sort of astonished at the almost exponential growth in the activities that our legal counsel does on the Oregon State campus. And it covers the waterfront. The city within the city is a good metaphor for us. I mean, we have a lot of complex faculty members and staff members who have complaints about their work environment, some legitimate, some not. We have a case of an individual this year who has filed 18 grievances. Obviously, there's a mismatch between where they're working and what they're bringing to the amount of time that is engaged in dealing with those sorts of things. And as the stress goes up out there in the environment, those things are exponentially increasing. Secondly, as we work hard on more transfer of intellectual property, creating relationships with the business community, doing research parks and things of that nature, the number of things that require on-site and on-time good legal advice early in the process as well as late in the process is only increasing as well. And so I think part of it is having people who have the capacity for this very wide range of activities, but also understand the community in which they're working. There's something unique about Corvallis that's a little bit different than Eugene, a little bit different than Portland, and I think we make less mistakes when we actually have folks on our campus who understand that climate and that culture they're working with, but obviously staying very well connected to the Attorney General's office in Salem. So I just think I'm actually encouraged by my President Frohmeyer's comments, and I'm also encouraged by the letter. I think when good people sit down and work through what the issues are in a private setting, we'll be able to come out with policy that will actually work well for all of us.
Chair Starr, Senator Deckard, I also served for a number of years as general counsel to a major university, so I'm also very sensitive to the role that lawyers play, and I'm also very sensitive to the need for me to stay out of the way when it comes to making legal decisions about my own campus. But we've been also working with the Attorney General's office to have a full-time special Attorney General assigned to Portland State, and we're pleased with the progress that we've been making on that score. So I'm optimistic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more presidents to come up. President Zinser and President Hahn. Thank you.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. And I would like to, I'm Elizabeth Zinser, president of Southern Oregon University, for the record. And I'm honored to have an opportunity to speak to that part of this bill that pertains to the retention of the interest earnings. And I do so on behalf of all of the university presidents in the system. And this is our pledge, as we present this to you, to exercise sound stewardship with respect to these funds, as we do all funds that under that come under our responsibilities. It is a wonderful new opportunity for us, and I'd like to spell out a few of the ways in which we feel that is the case. First, the underlying principle here is that these funds would not be used as a replacement or substitute for the core funding that we receive from state appropriations and from the revenues that we receive from student tuition. Rather, these interest earning funds provided in our hands for the use and the development, for the development of our institutions, would have a number of special values. In difficult times as we find ourselves now, they would be very important, though they're relatively small at this time, they would be very important in helping us to sustain access to quality education during difficult times. Southern Oregon University, just as an illustration, is seeing an increase of 55% in applications over this time last year, but again at a time of stress for both students and for the institution. Retention of the interest earnings would give us that marginal opportunity to be able to serve those students and provide better access. And during good times, these funds would give us an opportunity, again, with the emphasis on access to quality education, to do so by continuing to increase the quality of our education over time. So in short, they would enable us to serve more students and to serve them better. In addition, this would provide us an opportunity to build our capacity, not only to serve students, but also to continue to generate new technologies and new ideas that help to fuel the economy. They would help us in ways that allow us to invest in new opportunities that, for example, often come to us in ways where we must match funds with some special capacities. In science at Southern Oregon University, we've received some substantial opportunities for funding from the National Science Foundation and from the Murdoch Foundation recently. We're very proud of that. But we needed to work very hard to find funding that was required to match those dollars in order to be able to secure them. And all of our institutions have those kinds of challenges and opportunities. And the interest earning funds would give us that extra edge in being able to draw additional private and federal funds to our institutions. It would allow us to retain and to attract top faculty, which is always a very deep challenge for our institutions because of the competition for outstanding faculty. They would allow us to initiate more partnerships with our sister institutions, with our community colleges, and with other agencies in developing more and more capacity to serve the economy and to stimulate the economy by these partnerships and leveraging the capacities of our institutions. An example of that is the discussions that are underway to enhance our relationship among Southern Oregon University, Rogue Community College, and Oregon Institute of Technology to do more in our Southern Oregon region in the area of technology and engineering. And again, these types of funds would allow us on the margin an opportunity to stimulate those kinds of opportunities. And finally, I think another point that's helpful in this regard is to recognize those rising areas of demand in areas such as nursing and the need for more students in computer science, more graduates in computer science, engineering, and technology. And again, these funds will help us to provide greater access to those areas of great demand. And all of this we could do with funds that are not we are not seeking from the state appropriations, because at this time we understand they're simply not there. The the beauty of this act in so many ways, and this dimension of it in particular, is the opportunity to help the institutions help themselves and to be able to maintain the quality and the access to our education and to our technology capabilities. This provision represents, while a small amount at this stage, it presents us an opportunity to develop a new dimension to the social compact between our universities on the one hand and the people of this state on the other, a new dimension to our social compact that trusts the institutions to handle a new set of resources that we come to it in order to increase the quality and the access that we are obligated to provide, and we are prepared to take that responsibility. And I thank you for listening to this dimension of the Act.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you. Chairman Starr and Senators, I would like to speak to you briefly about purchasing procedures that involve the Department of Administrative Services and the Oregon University System, particularly with regard to information technology and telecommunications.
Please give us your name for the record.
Certainly. My name is Philip Kahn, and I'm the president of Western Oregon University.
Thank you.
As you can imagine, it's important for us to maintain as much flexibility and competitive posture as possible when we're purchasing, and particularly that is true in information technology and telecommunications. The Oregon University System, of course, is a dynamic higher educational environment, and we need the capacity to respond flexibly and quickly on matters of purchasing, here again, particularly in IT and in telecommunications. At the present time, though, only the Department of Administrative Services may enter into financing arrangements for the procurement of information technology and telecommunications of $100,000 or more in services or goods. This threshold, of course, was set some time ago, and at that time, many acquisitions came under that $100,000 threshold. At this point, however, it is not a reasonable threshold. In fact, Western Oregon University alone purchases over $1 million in computer hardware and software per year, and our sister institutions have many millions more than that. We feel that with the passage of Senate Bill 437, the Oregon University System would be able to enter into financing arrangements for IT procurements and would result in not only significant flexibility, but will save significant time because of the time involved in affecting contracts through DAS, and also considerable savings of money because we can negotiate and contract for services and goods in a university-specific way. It's obvious to all of you, of course, that we in the university world are heavily involved in information technology. And that's why I feel that the Department of Administrative Services has a role, but that role is particularly unnecessary and sometimes counterproductive when it comes to IT purchases. Universities have direct and highly productive relationships with the developers and vendors of information technology across the nation. Indeed, the producers of computer hardware and software vigorously seek our business, and it's for understandable reasons. We have computer sciences programs. We train students in information technology applications. Indeed, we are training a new generation of computer users. So people in information technology are highly attentive to universities. For that reason, and I've experienced this in many states, there's nothing as deep as a so-called education discount at times when computer producers are seeking business. And these discounts are for obvious reasons, as I say, because of our programs in this area. Also, the producers of computer technology are seeking institutions to do demonstration programs, to do pilot training and implementation projects. To make a long story short, there is a very natural interaction that DAS cannot facilitate in many instances. Another aspect of this, of course, Oregon's university stores sell millions of dollars of computer hardware and software every year. So this is another interface where there's some interplay at times between us selling computer hardware and software to students and buying it, of course, for our own uses. Now, we are eager to continue to work with DAS when it comes to matters of trying to aggregate purchase volume
so as to obtain better prices. To the extent we can work with other agencies and get preferable prices, the Oregon University System is eager to do that. We're also very eager to continue to work collaboratively with BASS on statewide enterprising network when it comes to efficiencies or better uses of computer technology. I won't go through the details of how we interact with DAS, but we wish to continue that interaction, but we do wish to negotiate directly in these purchases when we feel it's advantageous in terms of saving both time and money. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I believe we have no questions. Thank you very much for your
Thank
testimony.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have Ruth Ann Dotson and Doug Reagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ruth Ann Dotson from Portland, and thanks to redistricting, I'm a proud member of Senator Deckert's district. I'm also a former vice president of government relations at the Portland Chamber, who's been down here in the past also asking for support of higher education. And although I'm a member of the Board of Governors and proud graduate of Oregon State University and on the Oregon State University Foundation, I should also tell you that I'm the mother of a very proud University of Oregon senior. Because there's been terrific testimony up till now, and I forgot to give you, pass this out, I'm sorry, excuse me. I'm just going to give you the highlights of my testimony, and you can read the rest if you want to. Over the past 15 years, the Oregon legislature has changed the way that it funds higher education. More and more, our universities must rely on tuition and other revenues and not on general fund appropriations. These bills provide Oregon's universities with the tools they need to meet the challenge of declining general fund appropriations. First, you can allow Oregon's universities to be more flexible and efficient with the funds you appropriate. Senate Bill 437 contains dozens of provisions to do this. Second, you can provide Oregon's universities with a more effective toolkit to attract other funds. Other funds are funds obtained from the private sector, the federal government, and from the world of philanthropy. SJR 7 provides our universities with the tools they need to be more competitive in all of these arenas. As a member of the Board of Governors for Oregon State University's Foundation, a longtime participant in the public sector, and a former advocate for business interests, I can address both issues, but I will concentrate on how you can help university foundations help your universities. SJR 7 accepts the reality that over the past decade, nearly every major capital construction project on our campuses has relied on the investment of private dollars or other funds. By altering the matching requirements for higher education bonds, SJR 7 will leverage future investments in Oregon's universities. SJR 7 will not send Oregonians into an abyss of debt, and Oregon is a conservative state when it comes to debt, and SJR 7 will not alter that. As I said, I'm not going to take any extra time on the details of it, but feel free if you'd like to read the testimony later.
Thank you.
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Doug Reagan, and I live in Lake Oswego. I am a fourth-year trustee of the University of Oregon Foundation and serve as its co-chair of the foundation's Legislative Relations Committee. Our foundation has approximately 50 members. We at the university, I'm told, have about 60,000 eligible voting constituents of yours, and our alumni advisory board and our foundation support the legislation that is now in front of you. I personally have been a witness to the drafting, the discussion, and the work that has brought this legislation to you. Your commitment to public higher education is evident from the generous amount of time you've given us today and the fact that your names are printed on the bills that we are now discussing. As a trustee of the University of Oregon Foundation, I give you our promise that we will continue to work to make the University of Oregon better and to make the Oregon University system better, more cooperative, and more efficient. State higher education is supported by the state, by the federal government, by student tuition, and by the donations that go through our foundation. We consider our foundation to be your partner, and that this legislation is essential to continuing to maintain the high quality of higher education in this state. As the state's support of higher education has declined below 20%, our efforts in the foundation to secure private funds have been never more important. Approval of the legislative package before you is crucial to our fundraising efforts. Putting it very simply, we'll get more bang for our buck, and you will too, if this legislation is passed. My colleagues on the University of Oregon Foundation include many people who in the business community are familiar to you. Tim Boyle from Columbia Sportswear, Jordan Snitzer, former Intel Vice President Keith Thompson, Randy Pape, Bill Swindells Jr., Gretchen Pierce, Dan Justina, Brian Obey, Don Tykeson, and many others. Many of these people are members and leaders of the business associations that have reported to you earlier supporting this legislation. And we, and I'm proud to say Ruth Ann and I, have a lot of friends on the various foundations who are very interested in the cooperative effort between our various institutions to get this legislation passed. All of these folks are committing their dollars and their time to help ensure that all qualified Oregonians who want to attend the University of Oregon and our other institutions are able to do so, regardless of their financial situation. They are working hard to raise private funds for the universities. President Frohmeyer and the other university presidents have already mentioned our efforts in this regard. A key goal of which is to increase scholarships and financial aid for Oregon students, as a significant portion of the private dollars we raise will be going to that purpose. Mm-hmm. We are doing our part, but we will only be successful if you folks join us in that effort. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and be pleased to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I believe there's no questions. I'm going to deviate slightly from our posted order here. I'm going to invite our Attorney General, Hardy Meyer, to come up. And at the same time, I'm going to excuse myself for just a few moments. I'll be right back.
Thank you very much, Senator Morissette, Senator Deckard. I very much appreciate the Chancellor's willingness to work with the Department of Justice to address the concerns that I have raised to him about the provisions of the legislation that relate to legal services. And I look forward to the opportunity to work with the members of the committee, interested members of the community, and the system to address those issues. And the concerns that I have raised to the Chancellor are in no way intended to contradict or dispute the overall direction of the legislation with respect to greater system and institutional flexibility. I think I recognize those needs as much, or at least as much as most citizens do. And I think that the effort that has produced the legislation is one that is to be commended. A great deal of effort has gone into it. I approach, however, the concerns I have raised to the Chancellor with two points of view in mind. The first is that the values which led the legislature to create the consolidated legal services structure in Oregon 30 plus years ago now represent values that are not transitory. They are enduring values. Values with respect to independence of legal judgment, values with respect to consistency of legal advice, to note just two. Those do not, I think, become less valuable over time. And the legislature has consistently, through that 30-plus year period, rejected efforts to erode that structure. It has stood by those values through that period of time and over the service of six, I think, now attorneys general. The second point, however, from which I approach the issues of concern that I have shared with the Chancellor are that I do not think that the values of the consolidated legal services model are, in fact, in conflict with the ability to provide timely, cost-efficient, high-quality legal services. In other words, to provide legal services that are consistent with the needs of the system with respect to speed, to nimbleness, if you will. I do not believe they are in conflict at all. And I really think that that proposition deserves to be part of the focus of the committee, as well as of the further discussions between myself, the Chancellor, the system, interested private parties, as the committee goes forward. Because that's the basic proposition upon which I'm standing, that it is possible for the legislature to preserve the values of the consolidated legal services model while still ensuring that the needs of the system, even in a period of change, greater flexibility, greater nimbleness, are met. That's the basic proposition. And I think that it is entirely appropriate for the legislature to examine that proposition anew. This bill invites that. I look forward to being part of that examination and hope that at its conclusion, the committee's judgment will be one that can reflect a consensus view of the committee as well as a consensus view that will come to you from the further discussions that we're going to have. Certainly, I intend to approach those discussions in the most constructive way that I possibly can, and I, again, I deeply appreciate the willingness of the Chancellor and the system to reciprocate that approach. Thank you very much.
Artie, do you have... Well, I don't even know if I can talk. I'll have to ask you another time.
Well, may I... what kind of a timeline are we looking at for the resolution of this discussion item that you're going to have?
Well, Senator Morissette, I would propose to begin follow-up immediately, and I do not know what timetable Chair Starr wishes to accord the opportunity for those discussions to proceed. I spoke to him briefly today in terms of having some opportunity for that to occur following the initial overview of the bill by the committee. He made no commitment to me, nor did I seek any, of course. So I simply don't know what time he's prepared to accord, but certainly we would be proposing to move forward immediately with those discussions.
Well, I would hope that there would be some time to resolve these issues.
Well, again, here's the gentleman, I guess, who can answer your question. But
no, I was talking about the timeline that we would allow for the resolution of the item in question between the Chancellor's office and the Attorney General's office, because this, you know, I wasn't aware that this was something that might take some time. But I, as far as I'm concerned, that's it's important to
resolve the issue. Thank you. I want to allow some time, but I think we're on a timeline here where we need to see some movement. So I'm hopeful that you can tell me something of the progress by this time next week.
Of course, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
That would be very good, and I appreciate you bringing your concerns and. I know that the university has already responded that they hope to work with you and find some way that we can work together to solve this issue.
And as I have said earlier, Chair Starr, I appreciate very much that attitude. It's certainly reciprocated by the Department of Justice, and we hope to be able to come to the committee, insofar as this portion of the bill is concerned, with a consensus view.
Appreciate it very much.
We'll try.
Thank you. Now we proceed. Reem Nevin.
Senator Decker has a question stuck in his throat that he's going to address later on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rem Nivens. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. And I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 437 and actually to offer up a set of amendments, the Dash 3 amendments. And essentially, what these amendments would do would include community colleges in Section 1 of the bill that regards the adverse impact and the Office of Degree Authorization. It would include us with the university system, and I've had an opportunity to talk with Grant and Cairns, and they're okay with the amendments. But it would include us in to take us out of, to exempt us from the adverse impact statute and the Office of Degree Authorization. And basically, for our colleges, I'd like to echo what the president of Oregon State University said. We do have some concerns about our colleges being able to offer programs that are affordable, that are based on community need in their communities, without having to worry about challenges from private for-profit institutions that offer those similar programs. The president of Oregon State also mentioned, in terms of geographic proximity, that's also an issue for our colleges. In an instance, we had a college that was challenged on a program where the private provider was actually some 40 miles away from our community college. And for us, unlike what the president was saying about the internet access and, you know, institutions being able to offer programs in different areas, our students are fairly placement bound. And so for them, they need to be able to offer or be able to take advantage of programs that are in their communities, because they really don't have the ability in a lot of times to travel that amount of distance to take advantage of those programs. So we just want to bring that to your attention. And we also like to make the point that for some of our colleges, they also never start additional programs and never look at advancing their curriculum because of their concerns over adverse impact, over the sense that they're going to be challenged, and so they don't want to take that road to begin with. And so we hope you'll just consider those amendments and consider being amended into the bill as that part, Section 1. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of the committee? University presidents have not responded to these committee proposed amendments, but we would like.
But Chairman, we'd be happy to respond on time we get the work session, or we can tell you very briefly now that we've considered these with the Oregon Community College Association and do not have an objection to them. We think they would be compatible with the interests of the bill. And for the record, Grattan, Karen, and Director of Health Relations, the University.
Thanks, Grattan. That helps.
May I ask a question?
Please.
And maybe Grattan could answer this also. Is there presently any mechanism to discuss these differences with the private community or with the private schools to come to some kind of an agreement? Is there a process in place at the present time, is what I'm asking.
Mr. Chairman, Dragon Ferns again. There is, but we are at a frankly extraordinary disadvantage. This is a one-way street that we live on, in which any proposed program by any university and or community college at any place outside the campus of that community college or within it, if it is of a substantial programmatic nature, can be challenged by any private vendor in the state of Oregon, private independent college in the state of Oregon. We do not have, of course, the reverse appeal rights. They have full freedom of the entire footprint of the state of Oregon to operate in, but operate in such a way that we are restrained territorially by their use of the phrase in statute, adverse impact, any significant or material adverse impact. We've spent a lot of dollars, a lot of lawyer time, a lot of frustration, and have met numerous failures of trying to provide programs which would have financed themselves, met a programmatic need in the state, would have been served Oregon students at a place and time and process that would have served their own academic and personal interests by virtue of the process of having to go through that. The end result of the process is eventual arbitration and adjudication by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which is the home of the Office of Degree Authorization. That's all I'll say about that. And we think that this being the only one of these kinds of gatekeeping functions in the United States of America, the other 49, to my knowledge, do not have such a thing, and it being a vestige of a much different era in which, in fact, we were, as earlier witnesses said, state-supported university system with the ability of that kind of state support to be dominant in the market. We've gone from state-supported to state-assisted. We're on our way to being simply just state-located. We're no longer having the ability, we don't have the resources to go out and dominate something because we want to. We have the opportunity to meet a market need if it will finance itself, mm-hmm. and find ourselves constrained in an era when a student can sit down in their dorm at the Oregon State University, get online, get credit from over the internet course from Case Western Reserve or Michigan State or someplace else, be co-enrolled at Lynn Benton Community College, but they can't access a new program, and we can't access students who would want a new program under this kind of territorial control mechanism, which is a vestige of that an older era. And that's why we're seeking, and we join with our community college partners in seeking to be liberated from that kind of antiquated thing.
May I? Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Is this maybe a survival factor for some of the private institutions?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Morissette, there are witnesses who are here and will testify on behalf of representatives of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association and will address that to you and make their case. This is a policy decision which is we're bringing to you. We would say no. We collaborate with a number of the members of the Independent College Association in academic programs. We broker their programs and locations that we operate on community college campuses, for example. So, no, the answer would be no. But you will hear from those witnesses.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
That's all you have for us.
That is it.
Thank you kindly.
Thank you.
Now we have a bunch of student witnesses signed up, I believe. Mike Brzee, Bridget Burns, Greg Magnus, and Melissa Unger. Have we got enough chairs? We don't have enough chairs. Melissa's going to sit over here and frown at us. Please go right ahead with your testimony. Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Starr. For the record, I am Mike Brzee from the Oregon Students Association. I am also the Associated Students of Eastern Oregon University president.
My name is Bridget Burns, and I am the president of the Associated Students of Oregon State University and also a board member for the Oregon Student Association.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Magnus. I'm also a board member for the Oregon Student Association as well as the student body president at Western Oregon University.
For those of you who don't know what the Oregon Student Association is, we represent students from the seven public institutions in the state. We've represented students since 1972, and we will be discussing specifically sections 25 and 26 of Senate Bill 437. The Oregon Students Association does not support Senate Bill 437 without proposed amendments. Students would like to commend the Oregon University system for all the work they have done on Senate Bill 437. We understand the system is being forced to exist in the time of declining state support, increasing enrollments, and certain flexibilities within this bill would allow them to better deal with the situation. the goal of the Efficiency Act should be to unite higher education communities around the same goal of allowing Oregon universities to maintain level of high quality while increasing access to many students as possible. Students can stand behind this bill if we are assured that tuition will stay in the hands of the legislature. Senate Bill 437, as written, does not completely take out the hands, does not completely take tuition out of the hands of the legislature, but in conversations with legislative council, we've been told that this is the first step to do so. Students will not support any language that will lead to Oregon University systems and end goal of having complete control over tuition for two reasons. One, because we believe that the state has interest in ensuring an affordable and accessible education. And two, because students have been involved in the tuition discussion as constituents of elected officials for the past 30 years. In this Dash 6 amendment to Senate Bill 437, it is clarified that new fund being set up for the tuition and fees is not meant to be an avenue to eliminate the expenditure limit on non-state funds. The amendment allows the higher education student tuition and fees revolving fund to be created, and for the system of higher education to retain the interest of off of all funds in the account. It also clarifies that tuition is limited under expenditure limitations. This proposed amendment allows for universities to gain the interest and also make sure that students are comfortable with the bill and the changes that will bring to the system. The Dash 6 amendment keeps the current tuition process intact. The Efficiency Act is a critical step in allowing the Oregon University system to gain more flexibility, but should be done in a way that will unite higher education community. By accepting the Dash 6 Amendment, or something similar to the Dash 6 Amendment, students will not oppose Senate Bill 437 and will support the universities in their effort to be more efficient. Thank you for your time, and I will now turn it over to my colleagues from OSU.
As Mike previously stated, the Dash 6 amendment is meant to clarify that the tuition and fees revolving fund is not the first step in taking tuition out of the hands of the legislature. When Oregon...
You need to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Bridget Burns, and I'm the president of the Associated Students of Oregon State University. When Oregon created public colleges and universities, lawmakers recognized that not only the importance of higher learning, but also the state's vested interest in supporting and overseeing an accessible public university system. Currently, the legislature is an integral part of a check and balance system that ensures that tuition is fairly and effectively distributed. After hearing input from all the affected parties, the legislature sets limits on tuition levels. If universities need to raise tuition over the limits the legislature sets during the biennium, they simply must return to the legislature and ask. Legislative oversight of tuition provides a vital avenue for constituent involvement in tuition decisions. Students deserve the opportunity to discuss tuition with their elected officials and to be an influential part of the tuition setting process. If total tuition setting authority was transferred to the State Board of Higher Education or the individual campuses, the boards could choose to include students in the decision or not at all. On campuses, there is no way to ensure student involvement on the state board, and members of the state board are not elected, so there is no accountability, and they don't share the same relationship with the legislature as do their constituents. As representatives elected to act in the interest of the state, we believe that legislators provide essential input on decisions about education in Oregon. Legislators have the responsibility and the opportunity to ensure that our public university system is in line with the state's goals and objectives. The Oregon Student Association has been part of the tuition discussion at the legislative level for the past 30 years, and the system has worked well. There have been tuition increases and tuition freezes, but at every step of the way, students were involved. We are not proposing a tuition freeze. We just want to ensure that the legislature has the final say in how much tuition is increased. The State Board of Higher Education still has the authority to set tuition. It just has to be approved by the legislature, and having the final check seems like a logical and important step. The third special session is a perfect example of when the legislative's check and balance system on tuition protected students from a tuition increase. In the third special session, the Oregon University system supported a proposal to increase tuition. It was the legislature that made it clear that the cuts that the system should take should not be made at the expense of affordability and access. students have seen tuition surcharges ranging from 8% to 24%. And we understand that they were necessary, but that was because of legislative commitment to access that the 8% to 24% increases were not in addition to any earlier tuition increases. It was not easy for the universities. They were forced to cut budgets and dip into reserves, but in the end they made it work without sacrificing quality and maintaining access. With the crisis in access in Oregon, it is critical that tuition is looked at as the last possible source of revenue, and that the legislature is the final check in that process. It is critical that tuition remains in the hands of the legislature. Ensuring that tuition remains in the hands of the legislature so that Oregon Student Association can work with the Oregon University system in making our universities more efficient and affordable. Thank you for your time.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, again, my name is Greg Magnus, and I'm the president of the Associated Students of Western Oregon University. As my colleagues have said, for students not to oppose Senate Bill 437, First Amendments must be accepted. Students are not asking the universities to sacrifice quality. A quality education is as important to students as it is to the administration. We believe that quality can be achieved in our universities as it has been since Western was instituted as a public university, that is, with the legislative oversight and tuition. I want to take this opportunity to make a couple of things clear and additionally respond to what the university system is saying about having control over tuition. The university system claims that there will be tuition limits based on the market. Oregon has those institutions. Private institutions already provide higher education at a market value. But today we are talking about public education. Demand for higher education is at an all-time high as a post-secondary degree is becoming essential for success more and more students are trying to make college a reality. The demand will exist, but who is able to fill the demand with change will change. Middle and upper income students will be able to fill Oregon's universities. Their market price is much higher than students from a low-income background. It is low-income students that benefit most from keeping tuition in the hands of the legislature. Low-income students are the most price-sensitive, and the neediest students will be the first to be priced out of higher education. Oregon does not have a strong enough need-based aid grant system to provide for low-income students, and until we do it, it is critical that we protect them from trying to keep tuition increase as low as possible. The Oregon University system has claimed that having tuition-setting authority will allow them to ensure that courses are not cut and students do not have to stay in school longer. Tuition increases authorized by the legislature will also ensure that courses do not have to be cut. Students do not want courses cut. We just want the legislature to be the final check on the system's tuition proposal. Students are not asking for a tuition freeze. We understand that we will have to take our share of the burden of the state deficit, and tuition will increase over the next biennium. Our ask is simple, that we are at the table during the discussion, and that the discussion happen here in the public with the people that were elected. Just as in the past, the Oregon University system will be allowed to bring forward their proposal on tuition. It is true that the administration knows the most about the cost to run a university, and that is why their tuition proposal is given much attention and consideration before the legislature. The legislature is the final check to ensure that tuition increase is appropriate and that all is being done to protect student access. Currently, campuses are in discussion about possible tuition increases for next year. Students are being told numbers for tuition, but are not being brought to the table for this discussion. Here in the legislature, we are guaranteed a place for this discussion. As my colleague Mike over here said earlier, Senate Bill 437 does not give the university final authority to increase tuition without returning to the legislature, but it's definitely the first step in that direction. Approve an amendment to ensure that the Efficiency Act can be something the higher education community is united behind. During these difficult budget times, students want to support initiatives by the university for the cost-saving techniques, but having control over tuition is not a cost-saving technique. It is to ensure that universities can increase tuition higher than they believe the legislature will allow. I thank you for your time, and we're free to answer any questions that you all have for us now.
Senator Marcet.
Thank you. It's really, really gratifying to hear that someone has warm, fuzzy feelings for the legislature. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We choose to be a little different, so we want to make sure.
I should have raised my voice to make that a question, so you could say we sure we do. You know.
Just remember it's students that love you.
Pardon me?
Just remember it's students that love you. Make sure to take care of us.
Gotcha.
All right. All right, Melissa.
Chair Starr, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Melissa Unger. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and I just want to take a second to explain the amendments that were just passed out to you. The Dash 6 Amendment, the goal of the Dash 6 Amendment is to ensure that tuition and fees revolving accounts is not the first step in the university's goal of attaining tuition, complete control over tuition. And so technically what it does is it sets up a sub-account within the tuition and fees revolving account for tuition to go to so that the expenditure limitation, so that tuition can still be considered a limited fund within that account. But it does still allow for the interest off of the account to go to the universities, which right now goes to the general fund, and so we really support the idea that our interest off our tuition and fees would go to the universities instead of back to the general fund, so it still allows for that. We're trying to make sure we'll be working on that amendment in the next couple of days to ensure that it does everything that we exactly want it to, but our end goal is to ensure that tuition is still a limited expense within the higher education budget. And then also you were passed out a Dash 5 amendment, and that was an amendment we submitted in support of the public employees and also the faculty on the institution. They're going to be speaking right after us, so I'm going to let them speak to it. But really what it does is it takes out any references in the bill to the public employees board and any changes in the public employees board and the relationship with the State Board of Higher Education. So that's what those two amendments do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. We'll invite up Jessica Stevens and Rob Wagner.
Good evening. It is evening now. I know that this testimony is dragging on, so I will try to keep my comments brief. Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Today I'm offering testimony on behalf of our faculty at Western Oregon University, faculty and librarians at Eastern Oregon University, and adjunct faculty at Portland State University. I should also mention that our members are graduate teaching fellows at the University of Oregon and graduate employees at Oregon State University. AFT Oregon has concerns with two elements of Senate Bill 437. First, we have a question with Section 5, Subsection 1, which eliminates the current language in statute pertaining to health benefits, as well as with the companion language that goes along with it in Section 29, Subsection 4. It appears that the removal of this language with Senate Bill 437 could easily result in weaker health benefit plans offered as alternatives to our faculty members, in which case we would oppose removing the language from statute. It's hard to see how universities would be able to provide the quote-unquote same level, let alone a better alternate benefit plan in the open market to faculty and librarians, especially in communities like Monmouth, LeGrand, and Klamath Falls, without increasing out-of-pocket costs for faculty or reducing benefit coverage. President Bernstein from Portland State was up here earlier, and to say that he mentioned that that they would like the opportunity to provide, I think he said, more generous benefits, and we wouldn't have we wouldn't oppose that. I will say that an opt-out does exist in current statute. And especially in the Portland market, I believe they probably could meet the existing conditions that are stated in statute as well. Finally, I just make mention that on Sunday, this last Sunday, March 2nd, there was an Oregonian article on public employee compensation, and university faculty were singled out as being paid, quote, far less than their peers at institutions in other states. It becomes increasingly difficult to attract and retain quality university professors, which I think we all feel is a linchpin of a strong economy when compensation and benefits are continually eviscerated. The last portion of my testimony had to do with the cost for contracting out for legal services, and based on the testimony that was provided earlier by the Attorney General and others, I'll just refrain from mentioning those. We just had a question over what the cost would be, and would ask the legislature to keep an eye on that.
but we'll let the work group iron out some of those issues. We appreciate your consideration of these changes. They are, I believe, in the Dash 5 amendments that you have in front of you, and I'd be glad to answer questions you have at this time.
Any questions? Thank you very
Thanks.
Much. Good afternoon, Chair Starr and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm a political organizer for SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And I'm here today representing the approximately 3,000 OUS classified members of our union, as well as approximately 28,000 members we represent in other parts of state government, cities, counties, private nonprofit agencies, and in-home care workers, all of who care deeply about having a sound health care system and coverage. I just want to recognize that the initiators of this proposal from the business community spoke of fear of change, partnership, and flexibility. And we're here today to say that we certainly, particularly in the realm of higher education and the dynamic environment that it is, welcome and embrace change, yet also respect a fear of change when it comes to the words partnership and flexibility due to the past experience that many of us have witnessed here in the state of Oregon. Healthcare coverage is also why we strongly support Senator Morissette's amendment to Senate Bill 437 in Sections 5, Subsection 1, and Section 29, Subsection 4. Senate Bill 437 in Section 5, Subsection 1, and Section 29, Subsection 4 puts at risk both healthcare coverage for employees need, as well as a system for healthcare purchasing that is predicated on maximizing a cost containment. The Public Employees Benefit Board, or PEB, and its predecessors were created in order to achieve two key cost containment goals. One was to win efficiencies that come from the economies of scale of combining healthcare administration for all state agencies rather than having each agency pursue its own separate efforts. The second was evening out the state's bargaining power in relation to insurance providers, which becomes more possible when the insurance purchaser represents the largest possible group. Provider rate negotiations improve, as do opportunities for bulk purchasing and many other cost containment strategies, such as preventative healthcare programs. Senate Bill 437 proposes to go down a road that we believe will be detrimental not just to the employees of the Oregon University System, but also to the state's overall efforts to get control over steep health insurance cost increases that are affecting public and private workers everywhere. It opens the door to strategies such as adverse selection, leaving PEB with only the higher risk customers to insure, and signals with the language changes in Section 5, the new cost containment method for OUS might well just be to reduce employee health care coverage. In our view, these strategies do not help to deal with the health care crisis in Oregon, and they simply worsen the problem. We also have concerns about Section 3, Subsection 2A, and Section A, Subsection 1, which carve out special references to contracting out technology services and propose broad exemptions of the competitive procedures. We are unclear as to the intent of this language and believe that technology services are currently definable as services currently are in statute. While our collective bargaining agreement contains provisions for feasibility studies and considering large contracts, we believe that contracting out of technology services specifically can result in inefficiency, breach of confidentiality, incompatibility of technology services, and revenue loss. We, too, have strong concerns about accountability and responsible spending of our invaluable higher education funds and are willing to work with the interested parties to ensure that adequate safeguards exist for our tax dollars. We would support amending Senate Bill 437 to remove the new language in Section 3, Subsection 2A, and Section 8, Subsection 1. If President Khan's testimony is representative of the environment on all OUS campuses, as the target of a wealth of business solicitations, we certainly can afford to proceed with caution and accountability. We also urge the committee to not let the proposed language in Section 5, Subsection 1, and Section 29, Subsection 4 stand. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Deckard.
If I can get this out, just one question. Section 5, it says, should the same level of benefits. So I'm trying to figure out if the same level of benefits at lower cost, why should we not give them that flexibility?
I believe that language is being eliminated?
It's being eliminated.
Yeah. As it is proposed currently in Senate Bill 437.
Chair Starr and the ever-loquacious Senator Decker. what it does is it strike the language that says, should the same level of benefits be available at a lower cost through PEB.
Any further questions? Not, we thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thanks.
We have three additional, Gary Undine, Ray Gauthier, and Mark Walters.
Good afternoon, Senator Starr. I'm Gary Andine, the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. I reside in the district of a senator for whom I have great fuzzy, warm and fuzzy feelings, the vocal and always eloquent Senator Deckard. I think that in the spirit of the afternoon's testimony, I'd like to say a couple of the words about independent higher education state, since you've heard a lot of words about the state system. I'm here on behalf of 17 independent, nonprofit, regionally accredited Oregon-based colleges and universities. They and some of the other independent private sector institutions in the state enroll about 30,000 students, generate about one-third of the baccalaureate and graduate degrees given across the state of Oregon, have an overall budget in excess of $500 million a year, employ over 5,000 Oregonian residents, and using the same formula that President Frommeyer used to establish a 10-to-1 return on the public dollar, given the public dollars that the legislature invests in a very embarrassingly low student aid program in the state, the return on the investment from our sector to the state dollar is 300-to-1. So I think it's important that I set that stage when I give my formal testimony, which is in opposition to sections 1 and 2 of a 32-section bill. 30 sections look just fine and a good bill you should pass, but there are two sections that the independent sector of higher education in Oregon does have a problem with. These two sections are referred to would eliminate the adverse impact statute from ORS. The intent of that statute is to try to avoid creating tax-subsidized higher education programs or locations that could do one of two things, either seemingly detrimental duplication of programs or a significant adverse impact of one or more other segments of higher education. Private independent sector of higher education, both the for-profit and the non-profit parts of it, represents a considerable investment by and benefit to the people of this state. All voluntary investment, by the way. It has long been the intention of the legislature that those investments and those benefits be protected from the impact of potentially monopolistic and predatory pricing practices available to our heavily subsidized public higher education institutions. In 1996 and 1997, all parties to this issue met frequently to negotiate a procedure that would cause the least possible delay and disruption to the legitimate efforts of our public institutions to quickly start new programs in response to community needs. Our mutual efforts were successful, and the procedures we agreed to have been relatively benign, in place and working smoothly for more than 5 years. Essentially, the procedure is that the public institution posts notice about its plans for a new program, and then any institution from another sector, public or private, may ask for more in-depth information and consultation if it perceives that the proposed program could cause harm to an existing program. The procedure provides for escalation of concerns if necessary, and for ultimate resolution of dispute by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission if the contending parties cannot reach accord. In 5 years, the process has rarely gone beyond the 15-day notification stage and has never required OSAC intervention for final approval and disapproval. The statute has provided an important safety valve for potential intersector disputes, especially during a period when there is no state agency responsible for long-range planning, dialogue, or collaboration within Oregon's entire higher education industry, as exists in many other states, and when our state universities and community colleges have assumed they have legislative mandate and license to provide any and all higher education to any and all constituents, regardless of the consequences to other institutions or the ultimate cost to the state of a subsidized tuition and entitlement for each of their students, regardless of need. We are not interested in stopping public or private institutions from pursuing their missions and meeting the needs of Oregonians. A truly free and fair marketplace without one group of institutions priced subsidized by taxpayers would be our preferred modus operandi. Until that time comes, when the legislature refocuses its higher education access agenda to address the proven financial hurdles facing low and moderate income college students throughout the state, private independent institutions need the modest protection afforded by this statute to keep from being inadvertently crushed by a public sector aloof to our institutions and our programs. This month's program proposal announcement from OUS arrived in my office yesterday. It is attached to the back of my testimony. It describes four new proposed programs. I draw your attention to it because it is fairly brief. It's done by email. I doubt a lot of lawyers spend a lot of time putting this together. I suspect it was taken from language that was presented to the State Board of Higher Education and to the president of the institution in talking about the program. I draw your attention particularly to the highlighted phrase toward the end of the memo. The purpose of this email list is to increase communication among Oregon's post-secondary institutions, establish an easy, orderly process for expressing and resolving concerns, and provide a single point of contact in the event further information is needed. We continue to need that kind of cordiality among our sectors, and we do not believe it will continue if you leave sections 1 and 7 in this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to share these thoughts, and I'm available for any questions.
Any questions of Gary?
Well, briefly, I asked a question earlier of Grant Cairns from the Chancellor's Office concerning the survivability of some private institutions. Is that problem?
Senator Morissette, Senator Starr, yes, I, in certain circumstances that could certainly be a problem. When a state institution could come into an area and offer a program at one-half, one-third the price that a private institution might have to charge, that could very easily drive that institution, at least that program, out of business. If it's a very small school with only one program, it could easily be the demise of that institution. And the taking over of that program's costs by the taxpayers of Oregon.
Question. I also recall his statement that Oregon is the only state that still has that law, that archaic law. So how do... What happened in other states as this law?
Senator Starr, Senator Morissette, this is rarely put into statute. This is usually part of the rules and regulations that you find in the middle of a state post-secondary education commission or coordinating board or board of regents, where you would have a venue set where adverse impact of one program on another would have a chance to be aired. We have no such venue in this state, so the only place to lodge something like this is in statute. We would hope someday that there is that kind of a venue, by the way. But I think my two colleagues here might be able to shed some more light on specific instances of the impact.
Yes. Thank you. And please.
Chairman Starr, my name is Mark Wallers, and I'm the provost at Concordia University in Portland, Oregon. And I'm also, or Concordia is a member of the Oregon Independent College Association and the Oregon Independent College Fund. I'm also a taxpayer of this state, and I and my family have continued to work in private higher education, as well as continue to vote positively for every bill and measure that is set before us to fund public education. I believe that this bill and the intent of this bill, 437, is a wonderful opportunity for the Oregon University system. I admire the elements of it that provide for the opportunity for collaboration and cooperation. There's no two words in higher education today that are more valued than those two. Information sharing is important, helpful, and useful. One of my colleagues at the University of Portland used the information, the example that you see at the end of Gary and Dean's testimony, to negotiate with the business school at the University of Oregon after one of the programs was included from the University of Oregon in their business school, so that the University of Portland could make adjustments in its own program offering, new program offerings, so that would not directly compete, and they could provide a specific niche. Concordia as well has communicated both with Portland State University and with the University of Oregon when it created its MBA program, and Lord knows the last thing that we need is another MBA program in this state or maybe in the nation, but the reason that we offered ours is because we discovered a niche and a process for offering that program that would not be in competition again with other programs in the state but would serve the needs of students in the state of Oregon. Most recently, Concordia has been working with Oregon State University and their Department of Education in terms of offering education programs Oregon State cannot or will not be offering because the number of students is too small for an institution like Oregon State or another state institution. Therefore, Concordia can offer it because the critical mass we need to offer a program is much lower. Without information provided by this listserv and in terms of dealing with adverse impact, the opportunity to have these conversations would be severely restricted. To my knowledge, this has not caused anyone or any institution to stop new program development, nor does it cost any money to circulate this email. The adverse impact procedures have not only stimulated conversation and planning to avoid unnecessary duplication of programs, but fostered niche programming, as I've identified, to better meet the needs of students who choose to study in this state. Enacting Sections 1 and 7 would be a detriment to Oregon students and cause the cost of offering education potentially to rise, and especially in a tough economy, this is not a tenable situation. The current method of information sharing is cost-effective and efficient. And I want to, again, stress that that flexibility, cooperation, and collaboration are the exact reasons that I oppose Sections 1 and 7. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
I'd ask them, but I can't.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ray Gauthier. I'm the president of Pioneer Pacific College and many times president of the Oregon Career College Association. I represent that group of institutions in the state, which from non-degree granting trade schools through two-year associate degree granting schools, which look a lot like community colleges. We would specifically oppose Sections 1 and 7 of House Bill 437, particularly with the community college inclusion amendment. Senator Morissette asked the question about does adverse impact really impact the survivability of any private institutions? The larger an institution it is and the more broad-based it is, the less adverse impact is of one particular program is going to have on the overall health of that institution. When you start to look at private career colleges, some of which teach programs only in one particular career area, and some of which have only one program, the possibility of a public institution offering that program across the street at significantly less tuition certainly has an impact on its survivability. I would like to say that I believe that that adverse impact process is in fact working. As the president of the Career College Association, I'm pretty knowledgeable about all of those adverse impact questions or filings that have happened in the state over the last few years. As president of Pioneer Pacific College, I've been involved in a couple. They really are opportunities for the institutions involved to sit down and look at what that public program is going to mean to that private institution. And in the vast majority of cases, as Gary and Dean said, in virtually all cases, a little more information indicates that it's not problematic. There have been occasions where, as president of Pioneer Pacific College, I had an occasion to deal with Portland Community College, where they said, fine, we'll make this adjustment. As Gary said, none of these things have gone to the final step, and I believe that the effort that the public sector has to put into this is more than justified by the value of the cooperation and the protection it affords private institutions. During the past 3 years, Pioneer Pacific College has invested in two additional campuses in Oregon, one in Clackamas, one in Eugene Springfield. We developed many new degree programs. This investment increases Oregon's educational capacity significantly. That happened without one state dollar. 100% of that money came from us. I believe that because we did that, and because we increased the Oregon's educational capacity to the benefit of the state, that investment deserves at least the minimal protection that is afforded by that Detrimental Duplication Act. That we at least be notified, we at least have an opportunity to say this is problematic for us, we have a forum to discuss why it's problematic and how it might be resolved, and if it does get to the end, and it never has yet, there is a court of last resort who can make a decision as to what's really in the best interest of Oregon citizens and Oregon educational capacity as a whole. And I think it should stay. Thank you.
Senator Morissette. Well,
thank you. What's the court of last resort?
The court of last resort is the state scholarship, the OSS.
Student assistance.
They changed their name, and I always bundle it. Is the student assistance commission?
So the commissioners. The
commissioners would ultimately hear, would be the last to hear. Their decision would then be final.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will not be moving this bill today. There's. I think we're going to. Take the amendments under consideration, and I regret that we're not able to move it today, even in spite of the overwhelming endorsement of sponsors. But we still have two witnesses. We have members that have got meetings, and I think it's unfair that we try to move this until, in fact, we have the opportunity to meet with the Attorney General and do some further work. So would the final witnesses please come up? I'm having real trouble with handwriting, so I'm not even going to try to pronounce those two names because I can't see what they say to me.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Lorreen Ferris McMurn, and I live in Salem. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll make this very brief. I'm a member of the Board of Directors for the University of Oregon Alumni Association. We are for Senate Bill 437 and SJR 7. I'm a graduate of UVO, as is my husband, my father, and my brother. I have two small children under the age of four. I'm looking down pipeline for vision. They will enter college in 2017. I have a little special agenda here. I would like them to go to the UVO or Oregon Public Schools. So I'm just in support of this bill. I don't want any of our public schools of higher ed to suffer. I want them to be as good quality now as they are in 2020, 2040, 2000, on and on and on. So, and I want every child, not only my two small children, but every child in the state of Oregon to be able to go to a higher ed university, public university. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jim Bernal. I live near Salem. I am the president and founder of Willamette Valley Vineyards. And I have some perspective on the issue from being in business as a recipient of a public education here at the University of Oregon, but also spending time in a four-year private institution here at Willamette University. But also, I served as student body president back in 1975-76 at the University of Oregon, and then later started with Robert Liberty, the Oregon student lobby. So got quite a experience in higher education issues. And that's from that experience in examining this bill. And as time has passed, I can see the wisdom of what is being proposed here. The provisions in this legislation will greatly enhance our four-year institutions, our public institutions, in meeting a new age and providing services in a new way and capitalizing into transfers to the private sector of valuable economic engines to grow our businesses. So I strongly advocate passage of this legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I believe everyone who wanted to testify has had an opportunity. I would hope that we will get a report back early next week so that we might proceed with passing of this legislation. And with that, I want to thank all of you for your patience and stick-to-itiveness here. And with that, we're going to close the Education Committee for the day.
Oh, Romy, sound off?
Sound off. 1, 2, 3, 4.